Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Chasing Lions is an empowering and captivating memoir. It shows the lack of self-confidence doesn't have to stop you from living the life you want and finding the love you deserve. Chasing Lions, one woman's 55,000-mile journey in search of her inner lion, is the book by Amanda Marks. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere in the UK, is Amanda herself. Amanda, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles.
Good to have you with us. Whereabouts in the UK are you today?
In Suffolk. Yeah, sunny. Well, not so sunny Suffolk today, actually.
Well, there you go. So, you're one woman's inner lion. Does that mean, do you think you weren't much of a lion then before the events that overtook you in life?
Well, I was a little bit of a mouse. So I basically had to go and find my lion. When I was at university, I was mugged by a gang of 12-year-olds. And it felt a bit, I didn't like that very much.
Right.
And I thought, right, I shall go and find my lion. And travel was my way. So I headed off. And, so this is the story of me trying to find my lion. I also wanted to find a real lion because I love lions. I've never seen one before.
Right.
So
where
it's a bit of a mixture of the two.
Where were you at university? What were you studying?
I was modern languages student, French and German at Leeds University.
Okay, so that wouldn't prepare you for a life on the high veldt then. So what you say you'd always liked lions. What sort of obviously the mugging was something that sort of spurred you into action. But a lot of people say, okay, well, I'm going to change my life. I'm going to do something different. But very very few do. So what was your first step?
Well, a friend of mine that I was living with found that there was a talk on by this overland company. So I didn't even know there was such a thing as an overland expedition. So people pile into these trucks with, 15 to 20 people, and they head off. You'll have heard of the hippie trail to Kathmandu. So people do that and they go across Africa. I wanted to go to Africa. So in the end, I couldn't afford it. It was too expensive for me. And so I decided that what I would do is I would try and become an overland tour leader. So I decided I would learn to drive a 16-ton truck, which I did. And I taught myself diesel mechanics. Then I went and got the job. And I was pretty blooming poor at it to start with because I'm not very spatially aware, it turns out.
And when you're driving a 16-ton truck, though, that can be a bit of a drawback, I suppose.
There are times when you wish you had rather a smaller vehicle. I would quite agree. Yes, absolutely. Yes. Holes in the middle of Africa and 16-ton trucks and not a good mixture.
What part of Africa were you in? Or were we talking sort of presumably southern Africa then, yeah?
No, the whole of it. I basically drove from the UK down to Zimbabwe. And back again.
Wow.
6 months both ways. And 6 months down, 6 months back.
How many people actually sort of sit in the back, if you like, or because I've got friends who have done this. In fact, I think there's somebody in the studio who's done this as well. That you basically kind of live in the truck, don't you? Basically, it's such a big vehicle.
Well, it's an old Sainsbury's lorry or whatever, supermarket lorry that we then transform into like a bus, basically, and put bus seats into it. And there's anything, well, the ones that we took a maximum of 23. The most I had was about 18, 15 or 18, depending on the trip. But and then you camp, you wild camp or camping campsites if there is one. So you have a tent. At the time I was doing it, was little A-frame tents. And you do your own cooking. Everybody has a job. You get water on the way. You do what you can.
I mean, presumably this is a pretty good level, isn't it? Because if you, it's sort of, I wouldn't say rough and ready, but it's pretty basic, and it's a good way of getting rid of what the Americans call the BS, isn't it?
Definitely. Yeah, I would say it's very rough and ready, actually. But yes, you don't. Yes, you absolutely have to just take what comes. When I was doing it, of course, there was no mobile phones. This was years ago that I did it. So it was no mobile phones. There was no internet. So when you went off, you pretty well couldn't contact anybody. There's times when nobody knew where you were for like 5 weeks even, you know.
Presumably this was your first trip, must have been when you were first as an overland explorer, tour guide, diesel mechanic, spatially aware parking person. I mean, when you actually headed into Africa with 16 people, 16 souls behind you, looking to you for that inspiration, that guidance, that almost Crocodile Dundee-esque leadership quality, you must have thought, what am I doing here? I should be putting the umlaut somewhere rather than doing this.
You're quite right. It was not. I mean, I'm 5'2" and I'm little, and you know, most overland drivers are male, and they were then anyway. And and I didn't really think people would listen to me because I didn't have much self-confidence. So that had to build over time. And it was a bloody great shock to me when people actually did what I said, let alone listened to what I was saying. So, yeah, you're right. Well, very daunting. It was very scary at first, but I got over it slowly.
I'll let you into a little secret here, because I've got a hulking great 4x4 out there, which has had the suspension hired, and it's got a big roof rack on it. And when I get into a petrol station, I climb manfully into it and look around and do that whole posing by standing on the board whilst actually turning it on and have a good look. It's an incredible...
Got to.
Exactly, but it's an incredibly macho kind of thing. So how did 5'2", eyes of blue yourself, manage to stamp your authority then on this, you know, boringly macho kind of world?
Do you know what? At the end of the day, it's about knowing what you're doing. That's all. But also, I had a bloke with me. There was always two. So I was the leader sometimes I was the co-driver. It depended on the trip I was doing. So, for example, the first Trans-Africa trip I did, I was the co-driver. But the second one, I was the leader. But because of my size, they always partnered me with a bloke, just in case.
Right.
And also, you know, I'm not the strongest person, so I needed somebody that had a bit of strength as well. So I was with a bloke, but at the end of the day, it is about what you know. And once you've done it and you know what you're doing, if you're confident and you find the confidence to share with everybody, people, you know, they follow you.
Did you have that sort of ever having one of those sort of like swan moments where you're supposed to look sort of serene above the water and yet you're paddling madly beneath?
Oh, a lot of those, yeah, absolutely. And when things go badly, it's never good. And, you know, when you get stuck in a 40-foot bog hole in the middle of Zaire and you tell everybody to get into 2 foot of smelly water and dig it out, you know, that's not the best time. But I bet you they love it later, though. I bet they've got stories to tell.
Well, that's the main thing. You do go on these trips, don't you, to get a bit of sort of discomfort, because it ends, you know, sort of months later they'll be regaling people of the time they were in a 2 foot bog hole.
Absolutely.
What was the route, by the way? Because if you're driving from UK down through France, presumably, which is wild and woolly enough for me, where did you then go to get down to Zimbabwe or what?
Yeah, you're right. Down through Spain, across to Morocco, into Algeria, Algeria, Niger, Nigeria, West Africa, sort of Benin, Togo.
Wow.
Cameroon, Zaire, then across to Burundi, Kenya, Tanzania, and down to Zimbabwe.
So you're taking in, apart from going down through Spain and probably just passing in front of where the studio is, but when you... very much so, because we're literally 30 minutes from Gibraltar and from Algeciras.
Oh, well, then, yeah, there you go, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, and also you've got that, but the change of landscape, you know, when you hit Morocco and then go all to Algeria, and then you've got the Sahara in front of you. I mean, that must have been a bit daunting the first time you saw the Sahara.
It was absolutely brilliant. I loved it. I've always wanted to go to the Sahara. And actually, my first trip was a northbound, not a southbound. And on the northbound, we actually hit Algeria just as Desert Storm was breaking. You know, the war.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so we couldn't go through because Algeria wouldn't let us. So I had to fly over the first time. But the second time, I was doing it blind in effect, because I had to come back down through Algeria. And we did do it that time. Loved it. Oh my God, I love the desert. I love anything that's wild that is when nature is in charge rather than we're in charge, and we pit ourselves against that, if you like. And I love that feeling.
And when you do that sub-Saharan, you know, the bit, the sort of the Senegal, and then you do, you know, Ivory Coast or Cameroon. I mean, that is a change, because some people used to think, oh, yeah, Africa, it's all sort of one thing, and then you've got that And so what's it like watching people's ideas and their preconceptions of what Africa is like, and, you know, all the way down to Zimbabwe? Because Zimbabwe is a different situation as well. So what was it like watching people's and your own reaction the first time you did it?
It's a really good question, because, you know, a lot of people didn't have a lot of idea about what it was going to be like, myself included, really, when I first went there. And you face a lot of preconceptions about what you think people are going to be like. I'm sorry to say that I did honestly think that a lot of people in these rural villages you came across, you know, their education would be so bad that they wouldn't really know much. But it's rubbish. Everybody that you meet has got a level of common sense and intelligence and education that is right for them. And that, sorry about the dog.
I can see the dog, don't worry.
And, you know, it's fabulous. And do you know what else? Everybody is so generous to travellers that when you come across them and you meet some little person in a tiny little village that lives in a hut, and they invite you for tea, 15 of you, you know, it's just, it's heartwarming. And you change from not understanding the world to realising that we're all in this together, and everybody... Most people are absolutely fabulous. People are brilliant.
The book's called Chasing Lions. So tell me a little bit about then the build-up to coming across your first lion, because it's an experience that you never forget, I would imagine.
You don't forget that. Well, I always had this thing that I wanted to... my favourite book when I was young was The Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe, and I wanted to meet Aslan. That's basically why I went travelling. So that was... who I wanted to see. I wanted to see Aslan. And my first lion was in Zambia, in South Luangwa National Park, a beautiful, beautiful park, which is known for its massive amounts of hippos, but also huge amounts of lions. And the first one I saw was this male lion. He was under a bush, and he'd sort of melted into the sands. And he had these beautiful eyes, which, you know, it looked like he'd put eyeliner on that morning. It was all circumscribed with black, and he had a knot out of his nose. And he just put his head up and looked at us, and then thought, no, you're not very interesting, and put his head down again. So that was my first lion. But I was absolutely delighted. I can't tell you. I was so, so happy. I went on to see other lions. Of course I did. But he was my first. I still remember his.
And, you know, as the Americans say, it's also a journey of discovery, as the Americans would say. So, you know, you'd gone from being mugged by a bunch of 12-year-old scroats, and therefore, and then you suddenly find yourself, you know, facing your first lion. I mean, you must have sort of sat back and gone, you know, that if it hadn't been for that bunch of tow rags, then I probably wouldn't have had this experience.
No, you're quite right. And, you know, you have to embrace whatever comes across. And do you know what? After being mugged in Leeds, I was then mugged twice again. Can you believe the luck of that?
Well, in Leeds itself? I mean, we're not doing much for the Tourist Board, to be honest with you.
No. The second time I got mugged, it was in Burundi.
Right.
And this fella came on this journey. And this fella came out of nowhere and stole my bag. And he had legs about 3 foot long. Is that long? No, long anyway.
Yeah,
long,
yeah,
legs.
Yeah, long legs. Yeah,
and he just shoved his foot into my stomach, grabbed my bag, and pulled. And the first time I was mugged, I was silent. And I was so cross with myself, not even shouting. The second time, you should have heard the language coming out of my mouth the second time. I won't repeat it.
Well, it's only 10:45 here, so people will still be having their first cafe solo of the day, maybe.
Exactly. Not right. And then I was mugged again in Nigeria. And that time I managed to, and that time the guy pulled a knife on me. I seem to have a big sign above my head saying, mug me.
No, I'm familiar with that concept. Don't worry about that. Yes. But I mean, being a woman in Africa, were there, I mean, apart from having somebody put a knife on you, I mean, that's a whole game changer.
That was scary.
Yeah. Did you feel safe in Africa? I mean, because people
say, yes. Ooh. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
No, absolutely did. I absolutely did. I mean, there was times, but there's times, I mean, there can be times in London, can't there, when you're not feeling safe. So there's always the odd moment. But no, on the whole, I felt very safe. And I think the other thing is you just take precautions when you're in areas where you might not be.
Talking about those are some of the sort of blimey moments, if you like. But they get outweighed, obviously, by the moments that make up those high points of your life. And yes. I can imagine driving through Africa, there are, you know, and you've done this on several occasions, there are more than enough. First line sighting aside, is it nights on the, in Zimbabwe? Is it going through the Sahara? Is it, you know, the warmth of the people of, you know, Senegal, Cameroon?
Do you know what? It's all of that, but I can give you a few. One's a very special one. I was in a dugout canoe. I decided to leave the truck at one point when I was co-driver, and I went on the Zaire River, the Congo River. For 6 days, I paddled up the river on a dugout canoe with five of us, and we didn't know where we were going. And at one point, there were three thunderstorms all around us. We were in the middle, and it was pitch black. On a river that's like a sea, in a tiny dugout canoe, and there were lightning storms all around us. That stays with me to this day. It was amazing. The other thing, we went to a tiny village in Cameroon, and I had my fortune told by a crab sorcerer.
Now,
I mean, how beautiful is that?
What is a crab sorcerer, by the way? Did they scuttle sideways whilst telling you the story? I mean, just enlighten me, please.
Great, isn't it? So basically, this man, he is a mystic that lives in the village. He basically has a pot full of little crabs. He puts little bits of tiles in. He puts a lid on, plays a homemade violin really, really badly, to which the crabs go scuttling around these tiles, takes the lid off, reads the tiles, and tells you your fortune. I mean, who else has had their fortune told by a crab sorcerer? Not many of us, I'm sure.
Well, indeed, yes. And did the crab sorcerer and the aforementioned poor, probably tone deaf crabs by now? Did they mark out a path for you? And did the crab sorcerer's thing come true?
It did. I asked the crab sorcerer, "Will I come back to Africa?" And I did, and I have many times. His answer to me was, "Africa is your home."
Ah,
I love that.
Yes, that's not bad at all. And also, you got to meet gorillas, and that's got to be an experience.
Oh, I mean,
lions enough, but you know, gorillas must have been was that Rwanda, Congo? Whereabouts would that be then?
Yeah, that was Zaire. I've done it since as well a couple of times. It's one of the most special wildlife experiences you can ever do, because looking into the eyes of a gorilla, you're looking into your ancestors. You know you are part of the same family, and it is just so special. You get an hour with them. They are so unscary, and it is an absolute privilege. And you see these babies playing. And at one point, there was this young gorilla that came up to a friend that I was with. She was wearing black trousers, black baggy trousers. You're not supposed to touch them for obvious reasons, you know, cross-contamination.
Sure.
And he came up. She was backed into a bush, so she couldn't move. So he came and he picked at her trousers really gently and then sniffed his fingers. And then he walked off. He wasn't very inspired.
So when was the last time you did an overland expedition then? And what did it lead on to, if you like?
I stopped that. I did it for 4 years, 3 years on the road. And then I went and did the marketing for the same company. What it's led on to is that I now run a travel company of my own called Tribes in the UK. It's not overlanding, though. It's far posher. So I've gone from one extreme to the other, if you like. So we now sell safaris, high-end safaris in many places in Africa, as well as trips to Latin America and India, because my husband was also an overland driver, but he went to different areas. So we pooled our knowledge.
Right.
So began our own travel.
I was going to say, so love didn't blossom amongst the 16 tonners then?
It did.
Right.
I met him there.
And what did the crab sorcerer say about that one?
I didn't mention him. I didn't ask, though. Yeah, so he was my co-driver on his first trip. We actually, the first trip was in the Middle East and Egypt. After that, so we did an 8-week trip together. We had 8 weeks together. He then went off for a year to Kathmandu in India. I went off for a year to Africa. And after that, we met up and got engaged. So we'd only really known each other for about 8 weeks, really.
Well, and they said it wouldn't last. They said it wouldn't last.
I know. So what, that was nearly 3 years ago.
What was it? You were a child bride, obviously. What was the if you like, why did you decide to put this down in the book? I mean, a lot of people said, well, we decided to write this book because of lockdown, and I had a lot of time, and I thought I'd put this all together. And if you did do that, what was it like going back? Did you keep a journal? Did you have sort of logs from those overland trips?
Oh, do you know, I wish I'd written a diary. I so wish I'd written a diary, but I didn't. I wrote a few little notes. I had, and also had a few photos, so I did it from there. I also have kept in touch with quite a few friends from that time, so I picked their brains to try and remind me as well. But most of all, it is that thing of just making yourself go back to that place and really think about it. It's surprising what comes back to you. It really is. And actually, if you can place yourself somewhere, The memories do come flooding back, and even the feelings of what you felt at that time come flooding back. If you give yourself the space and the time to remember, to properly remember, I was shocked how much came back, and I absolutely adored it. And it was an escape.
I interview quite a few people, this being the nature of my job. And you know, I get to interview inspirational people like yourself. And there's always a thing, isn't there? Because you know, if it hadn't been for a small incident in Leeds several years ago, then you wouldn't have done this. And it's funny how life sort of turns out. So if there's anybody out there who's thinking, you know, I've been doing this job for X amount of time, but I'm really quite secure here, but I'd really like to go and see a lion in Africa or a hippo or a gorilla or just get lost in the Sahara, what would your advice be to them?
Oh, you know what my advice would be. Do it. Just do it. Do it. Do it. Do it today, not tomorrow. Just get out there. Life's too short, isn't it? It is just too short. Do not ever look back on your life and have regrets for not doing things. Get out there and do it. Oh, my God. If a woman that basically, you know, I went into Dragoman with the only thing I could say I'd ever won or done or made something really good about was the fact that I once became third in a German poetry speaking competition. And I went to be a tour leader, for God's sake, you know? So, you know, if I can do that, I didn't even like getting my face wet and I rafted the Zambezi. You've got to do it.
German poetry's loss is the overland industry's gain. This book is called Chasing Lions. It's by Amanda Marks, who we've been speaking to today. Amanda, if people want to find you on the internet thing, and the book, by the way, will be available to virtual download from our own virtual bookstore, and it's available at all good bookstores, etc. But if people want to find out more about you or about the book, you just mentioned that you've got a small bespoke travel company, but do you do the social media thing? Can they find you online?
They can find me at amandamarks.co.uk. I'm on Instagram at and nature wrote, and I'm on Facebook as well, Amanda Marks author.
We can find you there. The book is called Chasing Lions. It's by Amanda Marks, who we've been speaking to today. Amanda, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.